to watch the speech on television. Joan Kennedy was more persistent in her attentions, until she was ordered from the room by a short-tempered and tense Senator Kennedy, as time for the broadcast drew close. Kennedy took a place behind a desk. The desk and chair had been built up, using books as support blocks, so that the cameras were at eye level, to give a more natural angle when Kennedy delivered his speech. Kincaid was directing operations from the remote truck outside. Two cameramen were on the floor with Moore. At 7:30 p.m., Channel 5 newscaster Jack Hines announced Senator Kennedy's talk was being produced by WHDH-TV Boston. On cue from Moore, Kennedy began reading from a manuscript gripped tightly in his hand. "My fellow citizens, I have requested this opportunity to talk to you, the people of Massachusetts, about the tragedy which happened last Friday evening. This morning, I entered a plea of guilty to the charge of leaving the scene of an accident. Prior to my appearance in court, it would have been improper for me to comment on these matters. But tonight, I am free to tell you what happened and to say what it means to me. On the weekend of July 18th, I was on Martha's Vineyard Island participating with my nephew, Joe Kennedy, as for 30 years my family has participated in the annual Edgartown Sailing Regatta. Only reasons of health prevented my wife from accompanying me. On Chappaquiddick Island, off Martha's Vineyard, I attended on Friday evening, July 18th, a cookout I had encouraged and helped sponsor for a devoted group of Kennedy campaign secretaries. When I left the party around 11:15 p.m., I was accompanied by one of these girls, Miss Mary Jo Kopechne. Mary Jo was one of the most devoted members of the staff of Senator Robert Kennedy. She worked for him for 4 years and was broken up over his death. For this reason, and because she was such a gentle, kind, and idealistic person, all of us tried to help her feel that she still had a home with the Kennedy family. There is no truth whatever to the widely circulated suspicions of immoral conduct that have been leveled at my behavior and hers regarding that evening. There has never been a private relationship between us of any kind. I know of nothing in Mary Jo's conduct on that or any other occasion, and the same is true of the other girls at that party, that would lend any substance to such ugly speculation about their character. Nor was I driving under the influence of liquor. Little over a mile away, the car that I was driving on an unlit road went off a narrow bridge which had no guardrails and was built on a left angle to the road. The car overturned into a deep pond and immediately filled with water. I remember thinking, as the cold water rushed in around my head, that I was for certain drowning. Then water entered my lungs and I actually felt a sensation of drowning. But somehow, I struggled to the surface alive. I made immediate and repeated efforts to save Mary Jo by diving into the strong and murky current, but succeeded only in increasing my state of utter exhaustion and alarm. My conduct and conversation during the next several hours, to the extent that I can remember them, made no sense to me at all. Although my doctors informed me that I suffered a cerebral concussion as well as shock, I do not seek to escape responsibility for my actions by placing the blame either on the physical and emotional trauma brought on by the accident or on anyone else. I regard as indefensible the fact that I did not report the accident to the police immediately. Instead of looking directly for a telephone, after lying exhausted on the grass for an undetermined time, I walked back to the cottage where the party was being held, requested the help of two friends, Joe Goggin and Paul Markham, and directed them to return immediately to the scene with me, it then being some time after midnight, in order to undertake a new effort to dive down and locate Miss Kopechne. Their strenuous efforts, undertaken at some risk to their own lives, also proved futile. All kinds of scrambled thoughts, all of them confused, some of them irrational, many of which I cannot recall, and some of which I would not have seriously entertained under normal circumstances, went through my mind during this period. They were reflected in the various inexplicable, inconsistent, and inconclusive things I said and did, including such questions as whether the girl might still be alive somewhere out of that immediate area, whether some awful curse actually did hang over all the Kennedys, whether there was some justifiable reason for me to doubt what had happened, and to delay my report, and whether somehow the awful weight of this incredible incident might in some way pass from my shoulders. I was overcome, I am frank to say, by a jumble of emotions. Grief, fear, doubt, exhaustion, panic, confusion, and shock. Instructing Gargan and Markham not to alarm Mary Jo's friends that night, I had them take me to the ferry crossing. The ferry having shut down for the night, I suddenly jumped into the water and impulsively swam across, nearly drowning once again in the effort, returning to my hotel around 2 a.m., and collapsed in my room. I remember going out at one point and saying something to the room clerk. In the morning, with my mind somewhat more lucid, I made an effort to call a family legal advisor, Burke Marshall, from a public telephone on the Chappaquiddick side of the ferry, and then belatedly reported the accident to the Martha's Vineyard police. Today, as mentioned, I felt morally obligated to plead guilty to the charge of leaving the scene of an accident. No words on my part can possibly express the terrible pain and suffering I feel over this tragic accident. This last week has been an agonizing one for me and for the members of my family, and the grief we feel over the loss of a wonderful friend will remain with us the rest of our lives. Kennedy put aside the prepared text. He folded his hands, looked directly into the camera, and appeared to continue the speech extemporaneously. However, large cue cards picking up the text of the speech were held up out of camera range by Joe Gargan. These events, and the publicity and innuendo and whispers which have surrounded them, and my admission of guilt this morning, raises the question in my mind of whether my standing among the people of my state has been so impaired that I should resign my seat in the United States Senate. If, at any time, the citizens of Massachusetts should lack confidence in their senator's character or his ability, with or without justification, he could not, in my opinion, adequately perform his duties and should not continue in office. The people of this state, the state which sent John Quincy Adams, Daniel Webster, Charles Sumner, Henry Cabot Lodge, and John F. Kennedy to the United States Senate, are entitled to representation in that body by men who inspire their utmost confidence. For this reason, I would understand full well why some might think it right for me to resign. This would be a difficult decision to make. It has been 7 years since my first election to the Senate. You and I share many memories. Some of them have been glorious. Some have been very sad. The opportunity to work with you and serve our state has been much of what has made my life worthwhile. And so, I ask you tonight, the people of Massachusetts, to think this through with me. In facing this decision, I seek your advice and opinion. In making it, I seek your prayers. For this is a decision that I will have finally to make on my own. It has been written, a man does what he must, in spite of personal consequences, in spite of obstacles and dangers and pressures, and that is the basis of all human morality. And whatever may be the sacrifices he faces if he follows his conscience, the loss of his friends, his fortune, his contentment, even the esteem of his fellow men. Each man must decide for himself the course he will follow. The stories of past courage cannot supply courage itself. For this, each man must look into his own soul. I pray that I can have the courage to make the right decision. Whatever is decided, whatever the future holds for me, I hope I shall be able to put this most recent tragedy behind me and make some future contribution to our state and mankind, whether it be in public or private life. Thank you, and good night. Kennedy got up from the desk and went into the adjoining room to watch a commentary on his performance, delivered by Howard K. Smith of ABC News. The speech hit hard at the one specter Kennedy's attorneys feared most, a charge of manslaughter. It did so through his outright denial of drunk driving, and a reaffirmation of his efforts to save Mary Jo Kopechne, fortified by the revelation of the rescue attempted by Joe Gargan and Paul Markham. While no prosecutable offense, Kennedy denied any sexual misconduct, the shadow issue that had represented so serious a threat to his political career as to have preoccupied the counselors at Hyannisport in the composition of his speech. Richard Goodwin said, "They were trying to say something and still avoid the connotation of immorality. The old Irish Catholic fear of ever suggesting that you were screwing anybody outside of marriage." The rest of the speech was a painful, bedraggled account, constructed around the pitfalls of his statement to Edgartown police. A week of conferences had failed to fill in the gap of 10 hours the accident had gone unreported. Despite a disclaimer, Kennedy was clinging to the shock and exhaustion of his police report as the only handhold to defend his delay in reporting the accident. Yet by pleading guilty to leaving the scene of the accident, in the eyes of the law, he had forfeited that medical defense. Furthermore, no doctor had ever given him or anyone else a shock diagnosis. The injuries Kennedy sustained in the accident had not been manifested in the extraordinary catalog of symptoms his speech inventoried. Kennedy's escape from Gargan's nagging at the landing had been transformed into an effort to swim to Edgartown, so strenuous as to have incapacitated his ability to report the accident. It was a piece of legalistic logic that covered all bases, but failed to explain why Mary Jo Kopechne should have been left immersed for more than 10 hours while the senator grappled with scrambled thoughts. Nor did it explain why the simple task of informing police had been beyond his ability to perform. In wondering whether somehow the awful weight of this incredible incident might in some way pass from my shoulders, Kennedy came close to expressing the hope that somebody else take the blame for the accident, the aborted scenario he'd proposed that left a number of loose ends to account for, such as his alibi-seeking encounter with a room clerk at the Shiretown Inn. Unable to explain Kennedy's failure to report the accident, advisors had refocused the incident as a political problem, through a contrived and irrelevant issue of whether he should resign his Senate seat. To ensure against that threat, Kennedy had asked for a vote of confidence under the guise of advice. The speech ended with a passage cribbed verbatim from his brother Jack's Profiles in Courage, an effort to elevate the episode into a heroic mold more suitable to the Kennedy hagiography. But as Time later observed, there was nothing heroic about fencing with half-truths, falsehoods, omissions, rumors and insinuations of cowardice. And above all, Kennedy wanted it both ways. He asked to shoulder the blame for what happened, at the same time he was obviously begging to be excused. Kennedy was accepting responsibility for the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, he said, but he wasn't willing to accept with the consequences. Amidst the fabrication, one poignant truth surfaced in the speech. Because of his close friendship with the Kennedys, Joe Gargan knew the reality behind the health reasons preventing Joan Kennedy from attending the regatta and party. She was having a very tentative pregnancy and was trying to stay as quiet as possible in order to keep the baby. She wasn't expected to go to Edgartown this particular sailing weekend. Minutes after the speech, telephone calls began to pour into Senator Kennedy's Boston office. "We got 100 calls in half an hour. We would have had more, but people couldn't get through," Press Secretary Richard Drane reported. Response to the speech was overwhelmingly favorable from both men and women, from in-state and out-of-state. but you really can't tell until the telegrams come in. No formula or organized poll had been established whereby Massachusetts voters could register their opinion, Drain said. We're going to be no more specific than that. There was only one candidate in this election, and his staff was going to count the votes. But the Kennedy political apparatus was not relying upon the spontaneous eruption of public opinion alone to persuade the senator to remain in office. Mobilized at the barricades was a lineup of reactions to the speech. An indefatigable defender since the accident, Senator Mike Mansfield thought Kennedy's speech had answered all his critics. He said, "Senator Kennedy has made his case to the people, and they are now in a better position to make their judgment on him. He has my full confidence and support. Senator Kennedy has been beset by tragedy and trouble, and has become a marked man because of this. He has been the target of slander and innuendo." Another fellow Democrat, Congressman Edward Boland of Massachusetts, hoped ugly rumors had been put to rest. "Knowing Senator Kennedy as well as I do, and also having known Mary Jo Kopechne, I am convinced there was no kind of improper relationship between them." Boland was sending a telegram encouraging Kennedy to remain in office. The senator's service to Massachusetts and the nation was too significant, too outstanding to have it concluded. Boland was confident, "Senator Kennedy has the strength of character to weather this latest tragedy." Kennedy's position in the Senate had not been damaged by the accident, in the opinion of the Democratic congressman and later House Speaker, Thomas Tip O'Neill. "I say that Senator Kennedy can still be an effective leader. We need him badly." O'Neill grew angry, however, when asked to compare the broadcast with the Checkers speech of Richard Nixon in 1952. "I have seen a growing disgust in Washington with the press of America, with the way you have handled this," O'Neill said. "I don't think the Nixon incident should be dragged into this by you people." But that comparison was inevitable and ubiquitous. A post-speech television commentary by John Chancellor that drew the parallel prompted more than 800 calls of protest. An NBC spokesman defending the analogy revealed reaction to the speech to have been unanimously anti-Kennedy. 1 hour after the speech, Gwen Kopechne stepped onto the porch of a neighbor to read haltingly from a handwritten text. "I am satisfied with the senator's statement, and do hope he decides to stay on in the Senate," Mrs. Kopechne explained later. "I was satisfied that he came forward and said anything. Before that, I was going out of my mind. Questions. There are lots of questions. That's what I go on from day to day. The unanswered questions." In the week the senator had been in seclusion with advisors, he had maintained as calculated a silence with the Kopechnes as he had with the press, without the pretext of jeopardizing his legal position. No word had been disclosed to them about the death of their daughter, Mrs. Kopechne said. "The only people who told us anything were the reporters. Nobody else told us what was going on. They seemed to forget about Mary Jo, as though she didn't count." Unlike his wife, Joseph Kopechne was not satisfied with the speech. "Why didn't he speak out on that relationship between the Kennedy family and their workers that included all the other girls?" Kennedy had explained the accident. Not enough, but he explained it. In light of the broadcast, however, the Kopechnes no longer felt an autopsy of their daughter was necessary. Jimmy Smith had watched the speech with growing dismay. All signs of deception were apparent in Kennedy's effort to cover up fear and distress, making a perfect performance difficult. "Whatever guilt was there came out," Smith said. "You'd have thought they had taken a tape and slowed it down. It was so depressed it was sickening. I wanted him to finish. It was, my God, hurry up and stop." Nevertheless, when the Cape Cod Standard Times sought the reaction to the speech of an assistant district attorney and ardent worker in election campaigns for the Kennedy family, Smith sang a different tune. "I think he was sincere. It was certainly satisfactory to me," he told the newspaper. The speech came as profound embarrassment to George Killen. "It was just foolish political talk. You'd have thought he was running for re-election from the gist of it. He didn't explain a goddamn thing about the accident. If that's all he was going to say, he'd have been better off saying nothing at all." Killen shared his dissatisfaction with Bernie Flynn. All this time, Killen's telling Denise, stay out of it. Let them handle it. Kennedy's going to give out all the details. We don't have to get involved, Flynn said. He's trying to keep Denise away from the thing, because Denise would only fuck it up. And the speech just pulled the rug out from under George's arguments. Flynn was convinced Senator Kennedy had lied in his police report. Watching that speech, I'm saying to myself, Jesus, this goddamn guy is lying again. He should have never gone on the air. He came off so badly. The speech was an insult to your intelligence. Whoever came up with that speech ought to be shot. Armand Fernandez confirmed the devastating effect on the senator's television appearance on the district attorney's office. He said, about 20 seconds after the speech, I knew Eddie would have to do something. Chapter 32. In Edgartown, Russell Peachey identified himself as the room clerk Kennedy had referred to in his television address. Peachey was patrolling the Shiretown Inn, because regatta weekends can be wild. We like to make sure the parties don't disturb other guests. Peachey had observed Senator Kennedy standing in the shadows at the bottom of a stairway, leading to a second floor, where his party was being accommodated. Peachey said, may I help you in any way? The senator had been disturbed by noises coming from a party next door, he said. I've looked for my watch and seem to have misplaced it. What time is it? Peachey looked through a window to a clock in his office. It was exactly 2:25 a.m. Because the senator appeared somewhat distressed, Peachey asked him, is there anything else I can do to help you? Kennedy replied, thank you, no, and returned to his room. Peachey called the Colonial Inn to ask the management to quiet the party. He continued patrolling his premises until 4 a.m. He had not seen the senator or any members of his group again that night. Peachey had not revealed the conversation before, because he'd been uncertain it was Senator Kennedy he'd spoken to, he said. The courtyard was lit by floodlights, but there were shadows. I couldn't see very clearly. I wasn't absolutely sure it was the senator. The man Peachey had spoken to was tall and had a Boston accent that sounded like Ted Kennedy. Although at that time I thought it might have been Gargan's voice. I wasn't sure it was Kennedy then, but after hearing him say on television he saw a hotel employee, I'm certain now I was the person he saw. I was the only person he could have been referring to. I was the only one around at that time. Peachey believed the senator's explanation of the accident. He could have swum the channel. It's impossible to measure a man's strength under such conditions, he said. I hope he stays in the Senate. He's too fine and talented a man for this state or country to lose in high office. On Saturday morning, Peachey posted a notice on the Shiretown Inn's bulletin board, fully endorsing Senator Kennedy and encouraging him to remain in office. While confirming one aspect of the senator's speech, Peachey's endorsement also added a new dimension of mystery about it. Kennedy had specifically identified a room clerk in the darkness while in turmoil of emotional trauma. In full command of his faculties, Peachey had to deliberate a week, so uncertain was he of the senator's identity. Kennedy couldn't have it both ways. Be in shock sufficient to prevent him from reporting the accident, but appear only distressed to have his sleep disturbed, and establish his whereabouts by asking the right time. A detail left over from the aborted scenario he'd proposed to Gargan at the Chappaquiddick Landing. In addition, Kennedy had made no reference to his automobile accident, foregoing another opportunity to inform authorities. Arena was mystified by Peachy's story. I thought, where the hell did he get that from? I figured he's giving Ted Kennedy an alibi. By doing so, Peachey was contradicting his police interrogation, in which he denied seeing the senator after he checked in on Friday night. I probably should have gone back to him on that, but I never did, Arena said. Once we got through the trial, I figured it's over, unless somebody comes up with something new. Kennedy's speech left Arena totally confused. Because I thought I was going to hear the complete explanation, and that didn't happen. I had his initial statement. Now here was a variation. The variations were considerable. In his police report, Kennedy designated his destination as the ferry landing. In his speech, he failed to mention that or his controversial wrong turn on Dyke Road and unfamiliarity with the area. The police report had omitted mention of the party and the rescue efforts of Gargan and Markham, but revealed Kennedy had been brought back to Edgartown. In his speech, Kennedy said he swam the channel, one factor that in particular intrigued Arena. Why the hell didn't somebody see Kennedy when he went back to Edgartown, even if he went over in a skiff or something? Nobody ever came forward to say they saw him coming out of the water or off the banking up to the Sharrowtown Inn, as busy as that place was. For the senator to have walked from the landing to the Sharrowtown Inn unseen on a regatta night suggested a deliberate avoidance of witnesses. Despite his private reservations, Arena told reporters on Saturday morning, "It was a moving and eloquent speech. The senator bared his soul to the country, and you have to admire a man for that." Had Ted Kennedy made the television speech at the police station when he reported the accident, it wouldn't have changed a thing. The only charge still would be for leaving the scene. "We feel there is no need to go into the matter any further." But Arena was in a minority with regard to the broadcast not changing a thing. Edgartown was in the grip of a media frenzy. Television cameras grinding up and down Main Street recorded residents' reaction to the speech. The most hotly debated issue was Kennedy's ability to swim the channel. "I'm not saying it's impossible to make the swim, but I don't believe it," ferryman Richard Hewitt said. "If Ted Kennedy were a normally healthy man and well-rested, there's no question in my mind he wouldn't have even attempted to swim this channel. His speech was a lot of baloney." Hewitt had supported Ted Kennedy in past elections, he said. "But I wouldn't vote for him for dog catcher now. How could he leave that girl in the water for 9 hours? Senator Kennedy's credibility was put to a public test when John Farrar, scuba diver and captain of the search and rescue division of Edgartown's volunteer fire department, dove into the ferry channel from the Chappaquiddick side, swimming the distance in 5 minutes. Farrar found the crossing tiring, he said. "A man of Kennedy's swimming ability could probably do it, but I think it was quite a feat based on his physical condition." But Farrar was critical of the senator's speech. "He didn't answer any questions. He brought on more," Farrar said. Assuming Kennedy was in shock, why hadn't Markham and Gargan contacted police if they were concerned enough about the girl to risk diving into Poca Pond in the middle of the night? If the fire department had been called at the time of the accident, there was a great possibility we could have saved Mary Jo's life, Farrar said. "There would have been an airlock in the car. There always is in such submersions. That would have kept her alive." Farrar had equipment to administer air to a trapped person directly, or to augment an air pocket inside a submerged automobile. "If we had been called, I could have reached the scene in 45 minutes. I say 45 minutes because it was dark. It had taken Farrar 30 minutes from the time he got the call until he recovered the body from the accident car, he said. That was in daylight. The lack of light might have caused a delay of 15 minutes. Arena disapproved of the carnival-like spectacle at the town wharf. A 40-year-old man followed Farrar into the water fully clothed. Then 6 young men made the swim ensemble. But there wasn't much he could do about it except maintain order. Arena had grown impatient with Farrar's pronouncements about the accident. John had all this stuff down pat about the air bubble and how long Mary Jo could have lived. The thing that bothered me about it was, John didn't know when he went down into that car what he would find. I'm thinking, was he really doing all this investigating when he was underwater for about 10 minutes? I didn't think so. But Arena had to reconsider his opinion in light of a clipping from the Boston Herald Traveler, dated 3 days before the Kennedy accident and mailed to the police station. A New Hampshire woman had spent 5 hours in a submerged automobile. Amazed to find the driver unconscious but alive, police rushed the victim to a hospital where she was given respiration and treated for immersion. Doctors said only an air bubble trapped inside the car had saved her life. Arena also received accounts of an accident in Salem, Oregon, in which the passenger in a car that crashed through a chain on a ferry crossing the Willamette River had drowned. Having escaped from the car to swim to shore, the driver was charged with negligent homicide. Arena's correspondent suggested, This is near what happened in your town. I think you filed the wrong complaint, don't you? Carmen Salvador acknowledged. Chief Arena is getting a lot of letters. They're about evenly divided. Those who like the senator will stick with him. As for Ted Kennedy's swimming ability, when the kids around here can swim that channel, they know they have it made. It's the thing to do. Arena himself believed Kennedy. Despite his bad back, Senator Kennedy looks healthy to me. I think he could do it. Arena told reporters about a dog we used to see every day downtown that was soaking wet and bothering people. Finally, one of my officers grabbed it and looked at his collar. The dog belonged to somebody on Chappaquiddick. Apparently, every day the dog would jump in the water and swim to Edgartown, have his fun, then swim back at night. And we chuckled about that at the police station. We figured if the dog could do it, Ted Kennedy could do it. Arena was not so amused about the rescue attempt made by Gargan and Markham and disclosed for the first time in the senator's speech. This revelation stunned police, who clearly feel that this information should have been given them at the outset and cannot see why it was not. Though both Markham and Gargan were at the police station, neither had given any indication they had a connection with the accident. Arena thought charges could be brought against a person who had known about the accident and hadn't reported it, but research showed Gargan and Markham to have only a moral, not a legal obligation to report the accident. Neither was liable for prosecution because of their knowledge of the accident for an undisclosed number of hours, Arena said. There's no violation on their part of any statute. While under no legal obligation to do so, Gargan and Markham could reasonably have been expected to report the accident, Time pointed out later. A prompt call to the police would have saved the senator from some of the innuendo that followed, if indeed he was innocent of drunkenness. The suspicion was bound to linger, that the only reason the two men did not call the police is that they were afraid that Kennedy was in no shape to undergo breath or other tests for alcohol. Thus, they might have chosen to risk the lesser charge of leaving the scene of an accident over the graver charges that might have arisen from drunken driving. The harshest deduction Newsweek made about their behavior was that their efforts were devoted almost exclusively in trying to get Teddy Kennedy off the hook. Indeed, the role of Markham and Gargan touched off the strongest reaction to the speech, a wave of editorial revulsion and reproach. By acknowledging belatedly their rescue efforts at Dyke Bridge, Kennedy had passed the onus of not reporting the accident onto Gargan and Markham. If Kennedy was in shock, he could not be wholly blamed for failing to report the accident. How defensible was the inaction of two men, in full possession of the facts, not in any state of shock, trained in the law and politically astute? Gargan's was irritated and angry about the furor, but he said, "At the same time, I understood the press didn't know the real situation. They didn't know what had gone on. So the criticism was rightly taken from their point of view. But from my point of view, I did exactly what I thought I should have done, and what I would do again." All Gargan was interested in when he dove into Poca Pond was saving Mary Jo, he said. "I wasn't thinking about the senator's political career at the time, and the press had no understanding of that." Gargan may have been the worst person to return to Dyke Bridge with Ted Kennedy, he said, because we had grown up together. We did that kind of thing, go into the water and try to save people. This was an automatic reaction. When an incident takes place on the water, you don't call the Coast Guard. You better do something damn quick, or it may be too late. The thing to do was get into the nearest speedboat or dive in, and that's what we did. A person not having that experience might have looked at the car and said, "Oh, Christ, there's nothing I can do." If it had been some guy who came upon the scene all hysterical and ran for the nearest telephone to call the fire department, that isn't helping Mary Jo. That wouldn't have saved her. You're doing that because you don't have the guts to take your clothes off and get into that dark, cold water and try to make a rescue in a car you may be stuck in. But you're doing everything the press loves. In the speech, Ted Kennedy did not claim that he intended to report the accident as soon as he swam the channel. Gargan observed, "The senator never did actually say in so many words that when he jumped into the water, he told Paul and me that he was going to report the accident. He wasn't in shock at that point. What happened to him after that, I don't know. So as far as press criticism goes, it may be well taken. Except to Paul and me, when somebody says, I'll take care of it, we presume that's what he was going to do. It wasn't our position to report the accident. But he did not live up to what he said he was going to do. Legally, Gargan was on solid ground. Nothing under the law would criticize what Paul Markham and I did. If I drove by that bridge and saw the accident take place and just continued on my way and did nothing about it, there's no law that would put me under any obligation to report the accident, Gargan said. Everybody is saying, those two guys are sons of bitches, and this and that. Granted, we may be, but there's no liability under the law in being a son of a bitch. It would have been unethical for Gargan and Markham to do anything about notifying police about the accident. As lawyers to Senator Kennedy, they would have breached the canons of ethics had they reported the accident without his permission, Philip Sisk, president of the Massachusetts Bar Association, said. There's no evidence they knew any time after the accident what the senator wanted them to do. The question was, when did Kennedy realize he should have reported the accident? Sisk was more concerned about the press briefings Edgartown officials held during their investigation, he said. If a man is a United States senator, that doesn't mean he is stripped of his rights, and they definitely were trampled on. Sisk was impressed with the senator's speech. I think he assumed a lot more responsibility than he had to. It was his personal opinion, not as president of the bar, that Senator Kennedy could never have been found guilty of leaving the scene. District Attorney Edmund Denise agreed the press briefings had been unwise. With such an explosion of publicity, no one could get a fair trial until it's over. He hadn't gotten involved because I didn't want to become part of this carnival atmosphere where the news media take over and conduct their own investigation. They do it every time. Reporters used psychological gimmicks to get public officials to talk, Denise complained. You're always on the defensive. You're wide open. I tell myself again and again, no comment, no comment. You begin talking and God help you. Denise would have ordered an autopsy in the case had he been aware of all the circumstances surrounding the accident, he said. When the medical examiner made his examination of Mary Jo Kopechne, it wasn't known that Senator Kennedy was the driver of the car. Denise's remarks angered Walter Steele. It's awfully easy to be a Monday morning quarterback. Apparently he is speaking from the living room because it was too hot for him in the kitchen. If Steele were to seek advice during the turbulent time that we had with the press, Denise would be the last person from whom I would seek advice. Steele discounted Denise's autopsy talk. Not only had the district attorney known Senator Kennedy was the driver of the accident car, it was his office which had suggested an autopsy not be performed, Steele said. Denise was notified last Saturday in my presence by Chief Arena of the death of the girl soon after the tragedy happened. Denise said, you handle it. It's just an automobile accident case. If you want help, I'll come down. Later, when the news was released that Senator Kennedy was driving the accident car, there was no move on the part of the district attorney's office to request an autopsy. Mary Jo Kopechne's body had remained in Edgartown until Sunday, Steele said. Denise had at least 24 hours to make a decision on whether or not to enter the case and hold the body for autopsy, and chose to do neither. In Steele's opinion, an autopsy in this matter would only result in the unnecessary surgical mutilation of the body of a blameless girl. It would add nothing to the fact pattern of the Commonwealth's case. That the Commonwealth's case was complete without autopsy or further investigation, however, was arguable, Arena conceded. A lot of people took the burn when Kennedy went on TV. They got aroused, thinking he was putting them on. The most vociferous of these made public his displeasure. On the scene, when the accident car was removed from Poca Pond, Dr. Edward Self had driven Arena to the landing for his meeting at the police station with Senator Kennedy on Saturday morning. Senator Kennedy's explanation of the accident contained discrepancies and hiatuses, which demanded answers, Self said. Had the senator made a wrong turn on Dyke Road, his headlights would have revealed water and the bridge in adequate time for him to stop the car. For him to drive off the bridge implied that judgment and reaction time were impaired, raising such serious doubts that self could not accept. The highly polished, indeed politically masterful, TV statement of July 25th, without retorting, "Just whom do you think you're kidding?" If Edgartown was suffering a miasma of doubt over the Kennedy broadcast, the senator was faring much better on the mainland. "It seems like we've handled 95,000 calls since Kennedy went on television," Western Union's traffic chief in Boston said. "Most of the people sending telegrams are for him." An estimated 10,000 telegrams delivered to the Hyannisport compound on Saturday morning were running 100-1 in favor of the senator remaining in office, Dick Drain said. Obviously moved by the outpouring of support, Kennedy was reserving decision on whether to return to the Senate. No announcement was planned over the weekend. While the speech was generating a flood of messages of support in Massachusetts, editorial response to the speech nationally was harsh. "Nothing Senator Kennedy said had explained his conduct convincingly to the Baltimore Sun. Kennedy remained a man who failed badly in long hours, not just a moment of crisis." The senator had given no real explanation why Miss Kopechne should have been abandoned in the car all night, or why the accident was so long in being reported to police, when others had known about it, the Hartford Courant charged. So long as Kennedy had not seen fit to explain the night's events, further investigation might be necessary. Reference to the health of my wife brought inquiries about a possible pregnancy to Kennedy's office. When Press Secretary Dick Drain called the compound, Kennedy told him, "Just say she's pregnant. She's expecting a baby in February." Concerned the information might be construed as a bit of sympathy, Drain delayed releasing it. Desperate for something to give reporters against the deluge of negative reaction to the speech, Drain announced on Saturday that Joan Kennedy was expecting a fourth child. That couldn't help matters very much, but it was the best Drain could do. Proscribed from commenting about the accident, he had nothing to say in the face of a torrent of critical complaints about the speech. The senator was unwilling to answer any questions about the accident. To all inquiries, Drain made a standard reply. "The senator made that clear in the statement, and if it wasn't clear, I'm not going to elaborate." On the defensive, anxious to salvage something from the ugly and destructive gossip that was being spread about the accident, Rose Kennedy disclosed in an interview at the compound, "Teddy has been so magnificent under a tremendous strain, which people don't know about. He has been overly conscientious about his father and about me and about Ethel, in addition to his own obligations. He has been so faithful in caring about us all. It has really been unfair, the burden." Mrs. Kennedy was writing to the Kopechnes, she said, telling them that having experienced the death of one of her own daughters at the same age, she understood their suffering. "And how badly I felt that my son was in any way involved in their loss, and that my sympathy and prayers were with them." Through her maternal testimonial, Mrs. Kennedy echoed the chords of a familiar family mythology. "I've always brought my children up with the idea that you have ordeals and triumphs," she said. "Some people call them the agonies and the ecstasies, the ups and downs." Putting the accident in detached perspective, Mrs. Kennedy explained, "God does not send us across any heavier than we can bear. How you cope is the important thing, not the events themselves. I'm sure Ted can rise above all this." Chapter 33. The senator's first public appearance since his broadcast was also calculated to subdue the negative response to his speech. That the press had been tipped off in advance was evident by a company of photographers awaiting the arrival of a Chevrolet convertible, driven by Joan Kennedy, that pulled into the parking lot of St. Francis Xavier Church in Hyannis on Sunday morning. Kennedy got out of the car to absolute silence. Then a scattering of applause began to build. A voice called out, "We're with you, Ted." Kennedy walked with his head bowed into the church. He sat staring at an altar dedicated to the memory of his brother, Joseph Jr., while Monsignor William Thompson read from the Epistle of St. Paul. No test has been sent you that doesn't come to all men. The mass concluded with America the Beautiful. The anthem had been sung in the church on previous occasions, Monsignor Thompson explained. Today we used it in tribute to Senator Kennedy. The senator's exit provoked another outburst from an unruly crowd that ignored the pleas of four police officers to maintain order. An usher escorting the senator to his car shouted, "This is church ground! Let's not make a carnival out of it!" Another demonstration greeted Kennedy's return to Hyannisport. Circling about the post office, 17 college-age Youth for Truth carried hand-lettered signs, "Can you buy justice?" and "Swim, don't run in 72. The group was disgusted, dismayed, and shocked by the senator's speech, because it appealed strictly to the emotions. The demonstrators were pelted with eggs by neighborhood youths, who shouted obscenities and let the air out of the tires of one or two cars that had brought the group to Hyannisport. Kennedy spent the afternoon on board the Marlin. The yacht was anchored for a picnic. Then Kennedy returned to the compound for a meeting of advisors and staff to evaluate the depth of a disaster in the making. National press monitors in the senator's office reported nearly uniform editorial condemnation for his emotion-charged address, which had raised more questions than it answered, for a gross failure of responsibility. By delaying reporting the accident, Kennedy had possibly sacrificed whatever slight chance there might have been of saving Mary Jo Kopechne, in the hope of somehow keeping his name out of it. In David Halberstrom's opinion, the speech was of such cheapness and bathos as to be a rejection of everything the Kennedys had stood for in candor and style. With all witnesses silenced, it was not clear why the moral issue should have been raised to voters, who have no way of questioning the cast of characters, James Reston said in the New York Times. To ask for a referendum on the basis of unknown facts was ridiculous. The only way Kennedy could get from the voters the kind of endorsement he sought was to resign and seek re-election on a platform of vindication, the Providence Journal suggested. Anything short of a formal submission of the issue to the electorate was an exercise in emotional bathos. For Kennedy to have resigned would have been an act of wisdom, clear perception, and high courage that would have been a healing service to himself, to his family, and to so many people who want so badly to believe him. Spokesmen put as good a public face on the collapsing situation as possible. Ignoring the editorial furor, Eric Cochner of the senator's staff said response to the speech in Washington was tremendous. We've had calls from all over the country urging him not to resign. Cochner had no idea what Senator Kennedy was going to do. If he has made a final decision, he hasn't communicated it to us. Registrar Richard McLaughlin chose Sunday evening to announce Kennedy's license, suspended because of a preliminary finding of fault in the accident, was being revoked for an indefinite period, as required by his conviction for leaving the scene of the accident. Kennedy had to appear at a statutory hearing scheduled for Wednesday, August 6th, at the registry's Hyannis office, but his attorneys would be permitted to answer questions put to him, McLaughlin said. We are interested in his functions at the wheel, what happened immediately before the accident. We're trying to establish the level of performance. The hearing could find serious fault or no serious fault, but nothing in between. The results of an investigation into the accident, conducted in cooperation with Edgartown police to avoid friction, was not being released, McLaughlin explained. All such reports are held in confidence, to avoid giving any party the advantage in a court case that might stem from a fatal accident. McLaughlin denied favored treatment had been granted to Senator Kennedy. Described as a politician whose arm-twisting tactics resulted in getting his own way around the statehouse in his 6 years as registrar, McLaughlin had been named to the post in 1964 for a term to expire on December 12, 1967. His appointment had been extended 2 years by special legislation passed over the veto of Republican Governor John Volpe. Cited as the finest registrar the state has ever had, McLaughlin won praise for his mission to rid the state of drunk drivers, the number one problem of highway safety in Massachusetts. In recommending legislation to reduce from 0.15% to 0.10% alcohol blood levels at which drivers were considered too drunk to operate an automobile, McLaughlin had charged courts were too lenient. Drunk drivers accounted for 600 traffic deaths a year, yet less than 1% were ever found guilty and punished. Mandatory jail sentences were needed if the law was to be enforced, McLaughlin said. We must make the consequences of drunken driving in terms of punishment so severe that that alone will discourage persons from getting behind the wheel when they drink. McLaughlin's private opinion of the Kennedy accident was rather more severe than his official stance. Leaving the scene of an accident and delaying a report for more than 9 hours, for all practical purposes, foreclosed a drunk driving charge. It effectively deprives officers of evidence of chemical testing and direct observation of the operator, he said. So if you wanted to avoid a drunk driving charge after an accident, that's how you do it. 12 sacks of mail delivered to Kennedy's Boston office on Monday morning were running heavily in favor of the senator, according to an aide. Other reports had responses varying from generally favorable to reactions split evenly, with both sides strongly opinionated. Drain had nothing to say against the tide of editorial incredulity about the speech. Instead, he relied on counts of telegrams and mailbags, overwhelmingly supporting the senator, and expressions of political coquetry about whether the senator would resign. Drain didn't know how long Kennedy would take to make up his mind, he said. He has no immediate plans. Drain refused to identify the second car mentioned in Kennedy's speech, raising the possibility Deputy Sheriff Huck Look had seen the senator and two friends en route to the accident scene at 12:45 a.m., and not the accident car itself. But Gargan had rented a white Valiant for the weekend that neither matched the license plate configuration nor the appearance of the black sedan Look had encountered at the intersection. Look dismissed the notion he could have confused the two cars, he said. I know black from white. That Look could have seen another car unrelated to the Kennedy party was not in the cards either. No one had come forward to say he'd been driving on Chappaquiddick at that hour of the morning, a prospect an aide in Kennedy's office conceded was probably unlikely. Gargan found Look's story puzzling, because at the time Look said he saw the senator. I'm convinced under all the circumstances that Paul and I had to be swimming in the water. How that incredible coincidence could have taken place with what Look says about the number plate and the color and style of the car, I don't know. Gargan wasn't as upset about the story as the senator's lawyers were. I simply thought Look was wrong. The witnesses Gargan had feared, at the time, might appear to say they'd seen the senator at Dyke Bridge and contradict the alternative scenario Kennedy had proposed at the ferry landing had not materialized. The only witness to have surfaced had participated in a singular encounter with the senator before the accident had taken place. Suffering under the glare of press vituperation as an accomplice in failing to report the accident, Gargan was keeping as low a profile as he could. The senator's speech was generating considerable support, he said. But it was also highly criticized and raised a lot of anguish and anger that, had it not been given, would not have happened. Much of the anguish was reserved for Gargan and Markham, singled out for the angriest questions about the speech, and labeled more guilty of wrongdoing than Kennedy. The notoriety had dispensed with Gargan's previous anonymity. Gargan was being pursued by the press. A pretty diminutive woman, Betty Gargan was furious to find Ben Silver of CBS at her door looking for her husband. Excusing herself, she took down a motto from above her kitchen stove, telling Silver, "Take this and read it, and get off my porch and leave this yard. I don't want to see you again." The motto said, "Great Spirit, grant that I may not criticize my neighbor until I have walked a mile in his moccasins." Gargan thought it was awfully funny. His wife had chased CBS News off their property. Outraged at the vilification leveled at her husband, Betty Gargan was even more incensed by the treatment accorded the young women who had attended the party at Chappaquiddick. She wanted to go on a talk show and give everybody a blast, because the press had been so unfair to the girls about this whole thing. Gargan said, to say what nice girls they were. Gargan could only concur. The truth was, these were girls of high reputation who I liked very much. They had been very loyal to Bobby. The purpose of the reunion was to talk about the campaign the year before. That was strictly the limits of that particular party. Gargan was tired of reading about six men and six girls at the party, he said. Other people who had worked campaigns were supposed to be there and didn't show up, so it could have been 10 fellows and 8 girls, or vice versa. It was as willy-nilly as that. Gargan bore the withering characterizations of him by the press in silence. He was in no position to clarify the issue, Gargan said. I wouldn't have tried to clear myself under the circumstances where I wasn't at liberty to discuss things I was privy to as a witness. Information that was nobody's business. It had nothing to do with Ted Kennedy. It may have been easier if the person involved in the accident owned the fish market in Hyannis, but that wouldn't change the fact that your obligation is the same. A telegram delivered to the compound on Monday morning was immediately made public. The Democratic Congressional Delegation from Mass strongly urges you to retain your seat in the U.S. Senate. We pledge to you our continued friendship, support, and cooperation. As members of the Congress, we are aware of what great contributions you have made to the Commonwealth and to the nation. You have exercised your role of leadership in the Senate with genuine brilliance and dedication. We urge you to continue in that role. That message was signed by John McCormick and all 6 Democratic congressmen. To some reporters, it was pure partisan politics. Other political pressures were encountering resistance. A nonpartisan bill in the form of a resolution urging Senator Kennedy to remain in office was introduced to the Massachusetts House by Speaker David Bartley. He would not force the issue. If there was less than unanimous support, Bartley said, if a vote would prove an embarrassment to anyone, I wouldn't have it take place. The resolution died in committee. The Fall River City Council voted 5-3 against a similar resolution. In nearby New Bedford, those seeking to register their support for Ted Kennedy could sign a petition, posted in the lobby of City Hall by Democratic Mayor Edward Harrington. A New Bedford radio station promptly demanded that a second petition be made available for those who wanted Senator Kennedy to resign. Station WBSM said in its editorial that such a petition was needed because of the inescapable conclusion that the overriding consideration that motivated Edward M. Kennedy during those tragic hours was the effect the event would have on his public image and his career. What was at risk here was the Kennedy image. Balanced against it was the life of a girl. Edmund Denise had no comment when asked if his office was looking into the Kennedy accident case. With uncharacteristic understatement, Denise added, "It's a tough spot for me." Chapter 34. Having failed to resolve the suspicion and doubt attached to the accident, the lid Kennedy's advisors hoped to place on the episode was threatening to be lifted by demands, most of them directed upon the district attorney's office, for a new investigation. The most dangerous of these was coming from Edgartown grand jury foreman Leslie Leland, a young Vineyard Haven pharmacist, earnest and conscientious about fulfilling our civic responsibilities. Leland requested a conference with Denise and Attorney General Robert Quinn. Leland wasn't as interested in calling the grand jury into session to look into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne as I was with our legal rights as jurors, he said. I wanted to clarify in my own mind if it could be done, because the press was putting so much pressure on me to call for an investigation. Leland learned that the grand jury had no legal right to call for an investigation at this time. In Quinn's opinion, it's up to the attorney general, the district attorney, or a judge, Leland reported. He didn't say which judge. That's the way he put it. A judge. Leland wouldn't comment on what Denise told him, because of possible political repercussions, he said. But Denise had made it clear he had no intention of bringing the case before a grand jury. But Quinn's advice was faulty, and Denise knew it. The grand jury had the right to investigate any matter it wanted to. All Leland had to do was file a written request with the Chief Justice of the Superior Court, asking for the grand jury to be reconvened in special session to conduct an investigation into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne.